Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Mind Shifters Radio with the Forgiveness Doctor, Dr. Michael Rice. I'm Jeannie Rice, your co-host. We also have co-hosts Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Bichette. We will share with you the wisdom of the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness. We offer tools and support 5 days a week. We will support you in building a solid foundation within yourself to live in pure love, in Aramaic, Brachma. Michael is the author of the book, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? For more information about the forgiveness process, please visit www.whyagain.org. And now, welcome to the show, Mind Shifters Radio.
Hello and welcome to Mind Shifters Radio. I'm Tim Hayes. I'm your host for the first hour, and today is Thursday, November 17th, 2022. As always, we're grateful to everyone who's joining us here today, whether you're listening live or through the archives, as we spend another couple of hours teaching and supporting people in using some of the most powerful, effective, efficient, and accessible tools I've ever encountered. These tools are available absolutely free through the tireless efforts of Dr. Michael and Jeannie Rice on the website at whyagain.org. If you go to that website and click on the two words Start Here, which you'll find in the upper left-hand corner, it will take you to a page where you can download and read Chapter 24 of Dr. Michael Rice's book. His book is titled, Why Is This Happening to Me Again? And that chapter of that book contains a narrative description of the primary tool in this work. That tool is called the Reality Management Worksheet, sometimes called the Reality Management Wake-Up Sheet. And it's a tool I've been using to great effect for over 18 years now to improve the quality of my life and most of my relationships, and to turn any negative emotional experience I have into part of the infallible guidance system that each and every one of us has been given. You can also download the actual worksheet process itself. It's a simple PDF file. Click the link, download it, print it out, copy it as often as you'd like, and use it over and over and over again, absolutely free. You can also listen to a whole host of audio files that have been curated out from the internet show over the years, in which people have been step through that worksheet process and or they've called in to give powerful testimonials about how the use of these tools has improved their life quality and relationships. You can also go to your app store and type in the three words Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness. And if you do that, before you're done typing the word forgiveness, you'll see the glowing heart icon. If you choose to tap on that, it will let you download a completely free and private app that contains the Reality Management Worksheet. Contains an abbreviated version of that worksheet process, and it contains a copy of the Dragon Klingon game, which is a wonderful way to introduce these tools to even younger audiences. And we hope people do that soon and often, because it frequently improves the quality of people's lives when they engage the tools. It also tends to promote comments, questions, answers, testimonials. If you have any of those to share with us, please give us a call, 563-999-3581. If you do that, when you call that number, you press 1, it will put the little icon of a hand by your phone number, and I will be able to turn on the microphone and announce you by your area code, and we can have a conversation. Alternatively, you can send us an email. You can email me at tjh@mindshifters-academy.org, and or you can email Jeannie at jeannie@whyagain.org. And if we get those comments, questions, answers, testimonials, we will address them on the internet show. And then as time allows, we'll send you a notice about what day and time we address that, your email or your comment or your question. And you can then tap into the archive to listen in and hear the feedback. So, yesterday, we finished rereading Lesson 29, and we're working through The Way of Mastery. history, and there are five more lessons left in the way of knowing. And I've had a number of comments recently from people who are saying that they're enjoying, and I'm not quite sure what that means. Some say specifically that they're finding usefulness in it, and others are just saying they're enjoying listening to the show. So before we move forward, I want to give an opportunity for people to comment about this as we, before we move into the last five lessons of the way of knowing, it strikes me that it's highly beneficial to stop every once in a while and get our bearings and understand what's the use, what's the utility of this work. We had some conversations happening in the support group on Tuesday that were centered around trying to make sense of what's our purpose in life and what should we be doing and doing differently. How do we understand the role of the mind? We had been listening to the work of Michael Singer, who's giving a series of lectures related to his book. His book is titled The Untethered Soul. And there's about 11 hours of discussion that he does related to that book, breaking it down in a different way, but going very slowly through the various concepts in the book. And one of the primary concepts he was talking about the last couple of hours we listened to was the mind. What is your mind? How to understand the mind? How to get a good perspective on how much value do you give the mind and trying to figure things out? And Dr. Michael Rice talks about, in the Laws of Living, in a lecture he has called the Circle of Life and How to Play It, he talks about how we have these spiritual faculties, and then we have the cheap knockoffs that our culture and our intellect and our egos have created to try and mimic the spiritual faculties. And we're living in a culture that teaches us and trains us about these pseudo-solutions or these knockoffs of these spiritual faculties. And in one of his lectures, he says, so there's the being mind is a mind that is awake and aware of its true nature as love and functioning from love. And that's your nature and that's your true being. And then there's the non-being mind, he says, and the non-being mind has these substitutes for or these cheap copies of the spiritual faculties, spiritual faculty of will and true perception, etc. And in one of his more recent versions of that lecture, he says that the number one pseudo-solution for the non-being mind, for the mind that's not functioning from love but thinks that it can think its way through whatever's going on, it can find a good answer, it can fix things, it can discover the nature of the world and your role in life. And Michael Ray says, it's the number one trap. we are never going to figure these things out. What we can do and what the ancient Aramaic process of forgiveness guides us to do is cancel everything that we think we want, whatever our conscious logical mind or our intellect is telling us. Cancel that. The Course in Miracles says open a curtain in your practice, put away everything you think you want, your trifling treasures put away, and leave a clean and open space for the Christ mind to come, for insight, for intuition, for guidance to come. And the trick here is that for those of us that have been trained in the Western mind, and this came up in the group on Tuesdays, some of us will say, well, okay, so I asked for guidance, but then how do I know I get the right guidance? Well, that's the ego jumping in. That's the conscious logical mind that wants to know. What we're being invited to in this work is asking to be shown and then staying open to whatever unfolds, rather than thinking we ask to be shown and then we're going to be given some powerful guidance that's going to let us consciously, logically know and understand everything and then come to the right conclusions. That's just not the way it works. Because our ego, our intellect, our conscious logical mind, whatever you want to call it, is simply not powerful enough to understand the flow of life, to understand the meaning of life, etc. It can make up meanings for life. It can think it knows what God wants and think it can come up with words that describe a true spiritual experience, etc. And yet, the intellect doesn't have that capacity. And so the primary trap is that we're going to try to figure it out rather than rest in the flow of life and creation, understanding that we are a part of the flow of life and that however life unfolds, one really good, one very useful way to look at it is that as life is unfolding, it's giving me an endless series of opportunities to learn to teach only love in this situation, and then this situation, and then this present moment, and then the next present moment. Despite the fact that there's a part of my mind that thinks, well, this isn't right. It can evaluate this and that and judge this and that and weigh these and these factors and those factors and say, this shouldn't be happening. As though my conscious logical mind or my intellect could possibly know better or understand all the factors that are involved in the flow of creation, the way Michael Singer likes to talk about it is, the 13.84 billion years that our scientists tell us has elapsed since the Big Bang. In other words, the creation of the physical universe and its process of expansion and unfolding. And, you know, for those of us who have struggled with high school algebra and geometry and trigonometry, it's really pretty grandiose to think that we're going to be able to comprehend what is the meaning of life or how the world should be unfolding differently than the way it is. And so one of the things we can do with the intellect, as the Way of Mastery has told us in previous lessons, is we can use it not to figure things out, but we can use it to simply set it up to tell us when we're off the mark with our use of the intellect. Well, how do we do that? We look for any indication that we are in tension or upset or contraction or judgment, and we know at that point it's that the discomfort we're feeling or the confusion we're feeling is an indication, like an alarm going off, that we are misusing the energy of the intellect. And so we can use the intellect to alert us to the fact that the intellect is being misused. I just thought about the power drill and most of the drills. Back when I was, you know, learning first about power drills. They were, they're quite a bit different from what they are today in that they only had two speeds, on and off, and there was no clutch, so to speak. So if you were trying to drill through something at the wrong angle or a wood that was too hard or a metal that was too hard, and the friction that was created by what you're trying to drill through was too much for the motor to overcome, you would, and we quite often did, burn out the electric motors in the drills, which meant you had to get a new drill. I mean, you could easily destroy a drill, even though it was a plug-in. We're not talking about the battery-operated drills they have today. But as the technology increased over time, these drills started to have a clutch mechanism, and then they would build into the clutch mechanism a slipping, or when it would slip, a click to alert us to the fact that we were trying to do something that was beyond the capacity of the drill, and that if we didn't stop, we could burn out the engine or the motor on the drill. Well, that's essentially what we can look at with our intellect. If our intellect can detect, if we can get better and better practiced at scanning the body and the various energy systems in the body for upset, for tension, for confusion, for constriction, for contraction, for anger, fear, sadness, any of the negative emotions, if we can train our intellect to be watching our own energy system every bit as much as we watch the outside world, or what we consider the outside world, other people, what they say, what they do, where they're moving, what their emotions are. If we can train ourselves to keep more and more, at least an equal amount of energy focused on what's going on inside of our energy system as we spend worrying about what we call the external world, then we can train ourselves to become aware of the earliest warning signs that there's been a misuse of our energy. What is the warning sign? It's tension, it's frustration, it's physical ache or pain, it's confusion, it's hurt, it's sadness. That is a way that if we then tag that awareness of some tension within us to a mechanism within ourselves that has us take a breath and turn the focus back inside and start to question, start to look at, why is this alarm going off inside of me? What is it that's being misapplied? Where is there an error in my thought? How or where or why or with whom am I trying to focus my energies on things that I have no control over? How or where or why and in what circumstances am I fighting against the flow of life? Like the image that came to me a couple days ago on the show, if I wake up and I find myself floating in a river, and it's a very rapid moving river, very strong current, and I wake up and I say, well, I'm not supposed to be here. This isn't right. And then right in front of me as I'm, you know, floating down this river, I see that there's a great big tree. I'm headed right for it. And if I sit there and complain about this and generate upset and say, well, how the hell did I get here? And I'm probably going to smack right into the tree. But if I stay focused on the fact that, oh, I'm here in the middle of this river, I'm headed toward this thing, if I use my body or some parts of my body as a rudder or my arms as a paddle, I can move out of the way of that tree and flow around it like the rest of this water is, I can probably avoid significant upset, trauma, damage, physical damage, etc., or even death by just going with the flow of life and using the current and my ability to move my body, etc., in an appropriate way. I get a whole different level of results. Now, it's okay if I want to be in the middle of that river and just complain. And maybe I flow around the tree, maybe I smack into it, maybe I get a little bruise, maybe it ends the experience of a physical life for me. It's okay. These teachings are, it's okay. Life is going to flow, it's going to be okay. We get into more and more trouble. We create more and more pain and frustration and suffering in our lives when we label the flow of life as bad or wrong. And I've watched really powerful, really 50 years, 60 years experienced spiritual teachers, and they talk all about this stuff and the Course in Miracles and the Way of Mastery, and they talk about love and the love is all there is. And then, without even realizing it, they slip into a few statements right there near the end of their presentation about how you better get going, right? The world's in desperate need of correction, and you bringing your energy of love to it. And wait a minute. I thought we just said that the flow of life is perfect and that all there is love and everything is God. And so the world isn't in desperate need of me doing anything. Now, the world that I think I would like to have, or the world that some other spiritual teacher is idealizing, may need things to change rather rapidly in order to get to, you know, by the year 2050 now, we've changed the temperature or the escalating temperature on the planet, or, you know, by 2050 we want to have no more wars on the planet. So if you say, okay, that's the goal, to reach that goal, then we better hurry up. But at the same time, if we say that God is the energy of creation, and God is all there is. There is just the energy of creation, and God is love, is another word people use for it. And then, you know, all of these other things about acceptance, and here's the Way of Mastery that says love accepts all things, allows all things, trusts all things, embraces all things, and that's the way it transcends all things. And we have that talk, and then we say, so you better hurry up, and the world desperately needs you to change this, and there's all these problems in the world. Well, to me, that sounds like I'm talking out of both sides of my face. And there was a point in here in the last couple lessons where I said, you know, if you read this book, it sounds like Yeshua is saying, you better hurry up. And I tried to back up and parse that out and say, he's only saying, if you want to be exactly where he is, you better get moving, because he's always moving and growing. He's always asking life. He's always asking the Creator, teach me more about yourself. He understands that he is part of an infinite expansion of creative energy, love, mind energy. He understands that he will never be finished learning about himself, about his Creator, about his role in the flow of life. This is not a journey to a destination point where we arrive and we're done. I had, I forget what I was reading or listening to, I think it was something I was reading within the past week or so, where the person was asking a question and saying, well, now it's absolutely been proven that once you reach enlightenment, that's a permanent state. But given that, here's this, here's my question. And I read that and I thought, wow, that's fascinating. I've read a number of different, as a matter of fact, all of the deep spiritual teachings that I've read that resonate with me and with each other, that have great similarities, they talk about how enlightenment isn't this permanent state that you reach it and then you're there. Enlightenment is a moment-to-moment awareness. And here in the Way of Mastery, in the fifth lesson where it talks about the keys to the kingdom, it says, look, if you start using the first four keys to the kingdom, right, if you decide to tune into and learn to discern this energy of creation that wants to express uniquely through you in each moment, and then you keep your intention, that we call that desire, and then you keep your intention focused on that throughout the day more and more. So you continually ask what does creation want to express through me in this moment? So you don't just ask once in the morning and then maybe once at night. The intention part of that is that all throughout the day I'm living with the intention to tune my internal frequency to the voice for love, the voice for the Holy Spirit, the voice of creation. And then, so I've got the voice of creation, the desire. I've got the intention to stay aligned to it. And then I move into allowance, which means I'm scanning my body, I'm scanning my energy system and my mind for the earliest signs of resistance. And when I find that I'm in resistance, I drop it. I pick up the tools and or I take the breath and or I use the EFT tapping and or I cancel my goals and I drop the resistance and I move into the state of allowance, going in the flow. And then the fourth key to the kingdom is surrender. Once I'm going with the flow, now I'm surrendering to be taught by life, by love, by the Creator, by the Christ mind, whatever word you want to give it, by the Comforter, by the Holy Spirit, by the breath of life, to be taught. I surrender to be taught, to be informed, to have my living informed by the awareness that I'm just part of the flow of creation and that everyone and everything I see is part of that same flow of creation. And that any experience of separation that I create is part of the process of perception. And forgiveness as a process is the process of dismantling perception. So I'm not looking at descriptions of life. I'm not looking at pictures of life. I'm not looking at sculptures of life. I'm in the direct experience of life. And in the way of mastery, in the fifth lesson, it says, when I do those first four things, my life is going to change so much. I'm going to prefer the experience of life so much that it's going to get more and more tempting for me to accept credit for it, to say, look what I've manifested, to say, aren't I a grand and magnificent person? And congratulations, Dr. Tim, for, you know, all of this work you've done. And for you know, in the beginning, I learned to say, well, you know, it's not me, it's just the Creator. But after a while, you know, I get, you know, 10 or 12 people in the support group and or I get, you know, 10 or 12 people on the phone queue and I think, oh, I've been doing this for 11, almost 12 years now and I'm pretty hot stuff. So I'm going to take, you know, 5 or 10% of the credit because, you know, there are other people who have spiritual shows and they aren't quite as, you know, balanced as I am because I've really, you know, so I'll take 5 or 10% of the credit. It's a trap. And that's where the fifth key to the kingdom is so important. The fifth key to the kingdom is the recognition that I didn't create myself, and I don't even know when I was created, and I don't truly know what anything is or is for. I don't truly know what my brother or sister need in any moment. And even in the moment where I'm staying focused and I'm asking to be shown what's mine to do here to... I have no idea what I do is the right or wrong thing or how it's going to work out for the best. I just want to try to align with an energy that takes the ego of me out of the picture, that takes a sense of separation, me from the other person, out of the picture, and then allow the flow of life to teach me. I like what Guy Finley says. He says, you cannot ask to be shown and then take a step in life without the truth of life showing you whether or not you're on track. He has several stories he tells about people that are out in some kind of an adventure, and all of a sudden they hit a brick wall or they hit, you know, a big cliff and there's a cavern and there's no way to see how to get through it or over it. And he says you have to take that step without knowing where it's going to lead. or how it's going to work out for the best. What you have to do is give up the stuff you've been doing robotically, mechanically, with that mechanical level of mind that he talks about, or with what the garbage that's been programmed into the intellect that the Way of Mastery talks about, or the non-being mind that Dr. Rice talks about. You need to give up the stuff that you've been doing that you know doesn't work, and be willing to be empty, without a plan, without the knowing from the intellectual mind. And if you're not willing to do that, you're going to keep repeating patterns of the intellect, of the ego, of the conscious logical mind, and you're going to try and make sense of it. And whatever sense you can make of it might give you some comfort in the moment, but it's pretty much guaranteed to not be anything like the magnificence of the flow of creation, which will come along sooner or later and do its thing. So if you are part of an infinite expansion of creativity and the one mind, you will never know all there is to know about you. You will be constantly learning, and therefore whatever insight or enlightenment you have, you know, Guy Finley has another thing where he says, I don't want to disrespect anybody. I just want people to know that when you have an insight, a flash, a spiritual awakening, you know, a peak emotional experience, he says, it's fun, it's bright, it's different than you've known before, and he wants us to know it's nothing compared to what's available. Michael Singer says much the same thing. He says, when you start recognizing the function of your mind, its true nature and its value, and you start putting it aside rather than letting it guide you into all of its machinations and turmoils and traumas and dramas, you step into a level of joy and aliveness and direct contact with the flow of life that just gets deeper and richer forever. If you take any blissful moment you've had, and it's nothing compared to what you'll have if you keep working at recognizing your true nature and the flow of life. And because 2 or 3 years from now, you'll look back and say, oh my gosh, what I'm experiencing now is just getting deeper and richer, and I couldn't even imagine this 5 years ago. Recently on one of the shows, Dr. Michael Rice has done, he's talked about a spiritual experience he'd had, and then he was talking to Susan Bingham, and he said, and I have this hunch that back when this spiritual experience happened, it was just earth-shattering, it was mind-blowing. And he says, because I've been doing the work ever since then, for 30 years or whatever, he says, I have a hunch that if I were to have that same experience now, it wouldn't be anywhere near as shocking. That's exactly the same message that Michael Singer gives us. It's exactly the same message that Guy Finley gives us. When you think you know, you don't know. When you have this wild, oh my gosh, this was so expansive and there was no time and I was in union with everything and there was total bliss and the light was brighter than I could look at and I could answer every question that was asked of me and it just flowed for me and it wasn't even me doing it. There was no me there and it was just great. That's fun. That's exciting. It may be brand new and it's nothing compared to what exists that you will go into, that you will be ushered into as you keep doing your work, as you keep releasing the tensions and judgments, as you keep aligned with your own alarm system, which you could arrange as your intellect. You can arrange to have your intellect be your alarm system. And you can arrange that instead of, as the culture teaches you, that when there's a tension or an upset, a physical pain or an emotional, you know, discomfort, your culture has taught you to scan your environment quickly and vigilantly to make sure you figure out who or what in the environment outside of you needs to change, or that you need to run away from, or that you need to attack, or that you need to bribe, or that you need to seduce to try to get them or it to change so that you don't have to experience the effects of your alarm going off. This work and many other deep spiritual teachings will have you, will extend to you the invitation that when you have an internal discomfort, you turn the focus of your awareness inside yourself and you ask yourself, how am I creating this anger, this fear, this sadness? How am I interpreting this flow of life as being bad or wrong? And it's, if it's the flow of life, it can't be either. Be either bad or wrong. Like the example that came to me the other day, yesterday or the day before. Here's my favorite tree by the river. I've gone there for years. I like to take my kids there when they were young. I like to fish by the river. I like to sit under the shade of the tree and have a picnic. And, you know, I love to watch the red-tailed hawk perch in the tree. I like to watch the squirrel scamper up the tree. And I go there one year. And a couple years before, the river had a flood and it eroded some of the ground by the roots, and the roots are sticking out, are all gnarled. And I'm saying, wow, it's fascinating. Look at that root structure. And, oh, now there's bigger fish that like to hide in the shade of the tree there, so I fish under the roots. It's wonderful. I love it. And then there's a storm, and a great big wind comes, and because the river has eroded the land around the roots, it pushes the tree over into the river. And now there's no more tree there for me to sit underneath, and it changes the course of the river. And now there's not, you know, a good hole there for me to fish for my favorite fish. And now I'm bemoaning the fact that the poor hawk doesn't have a place to perch, and that the squirrels that lived in the tree, maybe they died. And I'm saying, oh, this is terrible. But that's only a judgment that can be created in the mind of a human that thinks it knows better than the flow of life. And these teachings invite us to understand, to begin to explore, that the conscious logical mind that we use to get dressed and to drive to work and to make enough money to put food on the table is just a very simple tool. It is not our mind. It is not our essence. It is not the only source of information we can use to navigate through the world. We have insight, we have intuition, we have gut feelings, we have what some people would call the energy of the heart and the emotions. We've got other senses, flashes of insight and intuition that can come to us. They don't come through the conscious logical mind. They don't come through the intellect. And yet the intellect, the ego, can be a very useful tool as long as it's used at the proper time in the proper way. And when it's not used in the proper time in the proper way, it creates consequences. It creates energies like the clicking of the drill clutch that says, oh, you're misusing this. You're trying to drill something that's too hard for this motor ore. And if we wake up and use our intellect to first label and then scan to identify when those things are happening, what are the signs that I'm misusing my intellect? And then instead of blaming the tension or the alarm or the fear or the emotion that I feel on the outside event or the people around me, I take 100% responsibility for how it's the inappropriate application of the tool of mind or mind energy or thought or interpretation. And that's what's causing the tension. That's what's causing me to look at the flow of life and judge it and say it's bad or wrong. That's what's causing me to create a picture in my mind of the world as having a problem. You know, Michael Singer, in part of his lectures, was saying, without mind, without the human mind to judge this as bad or wrong, there are no problems. Problems are created in the mind of the human being that stands back away aside from life and judges it as bad or wrong. And he's just one of the teachers that has observed that. So we're being invited to understand at deeper and deeper levels, at different levels and levels of scale, how we are creating our experience of life. And in the last lesson that we were reading, and it was talking about karma, there are two impacts of karma. The first one is immediate. When I think a negative thought, the tension comes up in my body and I can feel it. I change the electrical flow of the body. I change the function of the structure of my cells in my body. In the Way of Mastery, it says the very cells of the body stop functioning the way they should when you judge. It says if you could see what happens inside your body every time you judge, you would never judge again. One of the headings in the last lesson that we read said, you know, I forget the exact one, but, you know, it's freedom is love under all conditions. Unloving thoughts alter the chemical balance of your body. Now, if you live in a culture that's taught you that your unloving thoughts are coming because you have accurately identified that somebody outside of you is bad or wrong and they either need to be run away from or attacked or they need to be bribed or they need to be seduced to get them to change, then you have one set of course of actions to, or a whole, you know, various sets of actions to choose from. But if you recognize that unloving thoughts are the result of a choice you're making, and then you realize that when you have an unloving thought, it changes the chemical balance of your body. It changes the way the electricity flows in your body, the chemicals function, the cells function, and you're the one choosing that process. Now you have a whole different range of options. Internal steps you can take. Breathe, soften, cancel a goal, redirect your thoughts, choose a new interpretation, ask to be shown, rather than race around interacting with people and things outside of you trying to get them to change so that you don't feel the negative experience. So our call-in number is 563-999-3581. We've got about 16 minutes left. How is this landing for you? What's making sense or not? Area code 541. You're in the air. Who do we have?
Shalinda.
Welcome.
How are you today?
Doing quite well, thank you. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. And I have, I really enjoyed your presentation this morning because I had an experience the other day. And for just about the first time that I've been aware of, I noticed my body responses. I have a real hard time sensing what's going on within my body because I've obviously shut it off from myself at some point to protect myself. So that was really exciting to find that there was a difference in my body sensation than what my mind was telling me I was experiencing. And so I was able to almost, if you like, shortcut the whole process of trying to sort through, or the first part of the worksheet, if you like, and get right to the point of what's my goal, and to soften, to breathe, and to ask to be shown. And it wasn't 5 minutes later, maybe even less, that I got sort of a focus. It's as if the lens of my mind's eye was blurry, or it wasn't focused, and it just kind of clicked into kind of a clear focus that, oh, this is what it was all about. Now I can cancel my goal, and I can resolve the whole situation in a way that there's no blame and no shame in either for either party.
That sounds useful.
It does, because Larry and I live very busy lives, and we have chosen simple lifestyles, which means a lot of our busyness involves foraging, gathering, volunteering, serving in various ways in this tiny community. And so at the end of the day, we've had a very full day, and to carve space out for myself to just make space for silence and solitude, since we live in a little motorhome also, for myself and others is very, very challenging. And so it's nice to have a method, if you like, or a process where in which I can just focus on my little mantras that I find so useful to settling down my body, and then working on breathing, because my breath is the first thing I'll stop and I won't even notice it, and then to ask to be shown in this neutral place of space. It's very, very sweet, because I can very often, and then after a situation like this, very often memories will start popping up that I had totally forgotten, and they could be 50, 60 years old, or 30 years old, or, yeah, usually more in the past, like more buried stuff, because it's not so recent, not so pushed far down in the subconscious to where it slipped into the lockdown place of my unconscious. And I'm being able to say, oh, that's the same goal. That's the same goal. Just do a mass canceling of all that I've recollected so far. And it's really been very, very helpful for me, and I'm so grateful for your reading, The Way of Mastery, and I'm also so grateful. We'll remind ourselves to be humble. I am also so grateful that you have shared your particular perspective that you are growing constantly, as all of us are, about what that means to you, because you have read it so many times that it's like those drops of water placed on the ocean of yourself. And I'm just very, very, very thankful. It's improving my perception of my intimate relationships. It's helping me to make space for them as well as myself. It's helping me loosen my grip on the future and how it has to be. So I'm just very grateful.
Glad to hear it. Glad it's of use to you. And that you're letting it be of use to you. Anything else you want to share today?
Well, I just have a little mantra that I say, and I already shared with you my poem mantra, which I have tweaked a bit. And for anybody who wants it, just send me an email at cylindermiller@mail.com, and I will be happy to share it with you. This little mantra is, May I embrace my world with all of the wide-eyed, soft-eyed, clear-eyed wonder I can find. May I cultivate an open mind, a gentle heart, and a willing body. Soul delights in such a garden to grow in.
Lovely.
I kind of think so, so I say it every morning as my mantra. I say, help me out, mantra. Thank you so much.
Well, you know, that's just, Michael Singer talks quite a bit about mantra just as a tool. And, you know, essentially what it does is it just helps the conscious logical mind get busy with something simple so that something else can step in and have an impact. So, blessings. Thank you for the call.
May I add one more?
Sure. Go
May
ahead.
I add one more short thing that's in line with all of this. When I was at university in Massachusetts, I was studying Russian as a major. And so, of course, we had a lot of literature courses. So I was reading both Dostoevsky and also War and Peace of Tolstoy. And one time I ran across a Tolstoy quote, I believe it was from him, where he said that nobody is to bridge my intellect for me and tell me how I should think. I will think and think and think, and when I come to my own natural place where my mind stops, then I go beyond. Then it's like, I don't use my intellect anymore. And I thought that was, at the time, I thought that was really, really profound. But it's like you were saying, not nearly as profound now as it seemed to me then. And what I've been realizing, reading mystics of all religions, as well as the conventional religious perception, is that Dostoevsky he used the path of the heart first, the mystical path first, and then he embraced his intellect and worked them together, integrated them into a very beautiful marriage, because intellect, in my mind, is the ego's false perception of mind, or ego mind, or whatever you want to call it. And then which is absolutely essential for our survival in this physical universe and practical. And then whereas Tolstoy went from the intellect, and when he reached his limits on it, he went to the mind. I mean, to the mind of Christ or whatever, you know, he went beyond intellect. And both of those were a marriage of heart and head. And the
quote that you just offered reminds me of Guy Finley saying, the mind will only cease its chatter and its attempts to fix everything, which of course is what's gunking everything up. The mind will only stop when it finally sees that it is the source of its pain, not the solution to it.
Right.
And then it stops. No one can tell me to stop from the outside. No one can lead me to rationalize something to stop. If the inside of me says, well, but this, you know, this is important and I need to do this, I'm going to keep doing this until that part of my mind sees, oh, I'm the one creating the pain I'm feeling. I am the source of my pain, not the solution to it.
And this isn't working, so why don't I choose something anew, right?
Yes.
And also the final little piece of this, we're getting around to a triune perception for me here. The final little piece was for this was when Carolyn Mace in her Anatomy of the Spirit mentioned something about the will, which is in the throat chakra. The will is the child. And she says if the heart, which is the mother, and the mind, which is the father, are at odds with each other, the child has no direction, and you will have a delinquent child. This is the individual will now, not the will of life itself when it's going its own direction. And I went, bingo, that's the triune. That's the whole Christian concept of the Trinity. And I went, wow. And that, the way of mastery, helps me with, too. Amazingly about Christ. What is Christ? Who is Christ? How is Christ? And where is Christ? And so now we have Creator, Christ, and the child. Christ is the child, Creator, the Father, Earth, which is the Mother. That's what I'm playing with right now. It's just a metaphor. Dr. Tim, it's just a metaphor, and maybe I'll have a better one tomorrow, but right now it works.
Okay. Okay. More power to you, as my dad would say. Well, thanks for these offerings and thoughts. I will mute you so you can listen in. Blessings. And, you know, as I was listening to Celinda there, the last part of it, I was thinking about Krishnamurti and, you know, these metaphors and these images and these concepts. I think this is this and that is that. And I was thinking about Krishnamurti, who was one of the first really consistent all the way from the first word to the last word. And if he would say, you know, there's a problem with the nature of thought, and so my thought is never going to take me to any solution because whatever it leads me to is created through that process that is flawed. So he constantly talks about do not build structures of thought, live in the direct observation of the moment. And then along comes years and years later, comes The Power of Now and Eckhart Tolle's book. And a friend of mine said, oh, you've got to read this fabulous book. And so I read the book because that's, you know, she's a very good friend and she was so excited about it. And after I'd read it, she, you know, had to have a lunch and sit down and talk about it, and isn't this wonderful? And I said, well, yeah, it's okay. She said, what do you mean it's just okay? I said, well, it's Krishnamurti light. And she got offended. I said, well, think of it this way. It's Krishnamurti for the Western mind. And she said, why would you say that? It was so many deep truths in that book. And I said, well, what is the pain body? And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, in that book, you know, The Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle talks about the pain body, which is a concept. It's a structure of thought. And he's going to define it this way, and he's going to have people, you know, relating to it and talking about it and arguing about what's the pain body and what's not. And if you listen to Krishnamurti's teachings, there are none of those concepts. There are none of those, here's a structure of thought that we call the pain body, and that this drives this and that, and you're operating from your pain body, and you need to drop the pain body from. And so there's a different level of rigor and rigorous application of the idea that you get out of the thought and you watch the thought and just let it run, but you do not let it move you. Guy Finley says, you can step back and watch the movement of your thought without being moved by your thought. And so the fewer of these images I have and ideas about a pain body or a structure of this or that, the less I have to undo when I move into direct observation. So again, just some thoughts, just some various teachers looking for the similarities. I will remind us all that we come from love. We're made of the stuff we call love. We actually are love, and everything else is false. Welcome, Jeannie Rice. And if you're there,
I unmute myself.
There you go.
Thank you, Dr. Tim.
Have a great show.
Thanks. So welcome, everybody, to the second hour of Mindshifters Radio. And today is Thursday, November the 17th, 2022. And our call-in number is 563-999-3581. And press 1, and that puts you in the queue to talk to us. And we'd love to hear your comments and questions because that makes this your show. Welcome, Michael.
Thank you, dear heart, and welcome, everybody. I'm delighted that you're here, that we get to move forward in this conversation about this amazing understanding that comes out of, pardon me, the first century Aramaic language and teaches us this skill of being able to reach into the depths of the unconscious mind and move through the traumas held there. And had a conversation this morning with a young lady that's been doing this work. She was sharing with me this morning, her first intensive at Heartland was 30 years ago. And as a child, she had polio and has had post-polio syndrome and has had several joint replacements. And back a year or so ago, I guess it was, she was having such excruciating pain in her shoulder that she couldn't even raise a glass of water. She actually started to use the Avacyn, and in a period of about 2 months, she was able to pack up her home and load boxes in her car, and when she got to her new home, unload the boxes, everything that the moving van didn't take, and was able to do that without pain in her arm. However, over time, the pain returned again, and we actually had a conversation yesterday, and there's several things I just want to kind of put together here in a package. And one of them was, and I'll just put this suggestion out, many of you have probably heard me speak of it before, but a really worthwhile investment to make. Costs somewhere from $3 to $6 to watch a documentary called All the Rage. I just found out that the documentary is now available on Amazon. I think it's $5 there. You can go to Amazon and watch All the Rage. You can buy it on YouTube now, apparently. You can go to a website called All the Rage Doc, as in All the Rage Doctor, D-O-C, alltheragedoc.com. And you can purchase it there, and they give you a link to watch it on one of the other streaming services. In any event, it's a powerful look at, and I've seen several people, Keeler, who had excruciating back pain, and I reported on this a few months ago when this happened, for years. And in the middle of watching this video, and it's the life story of a man named Dr. John Sarno, who teaches that back pain and much of other pain in the structure is actually unconscious rage. And that it's a physical experience of physical pain caused by the mind that wants to hide its rage from itself and pretend there's no rage. And he lays out the trick that the mind plays, that when an injury occurs, the mind will then take the unresolved rage and trick us into believing that it's physical pain in a part of the structure, which he affirms as a medical doctor and surgeon, it is. But he stopped doing surgery years ago. He actually was, I think, 93 when he passed, just a couple of years ago now. But he stopped doing surgery and started to teach people that their pain was their unconscious rage. So in any event, this young lady was sharing with me yesterday that her shoulder was back into Hurtsville. And it's like, well, let's see. If, in fact, there's a real physical problem, then how is it that for a period of months you were able to alleviate that pain and here it is back? And she was telling me that just a few weeks ago she had a whole week where there was just no pain there. So we started to explore what was going on under the surface, and I invited her to do some worksheets around it and to watch this video. So she watched it last night and we spoke this morning. And as she breathed and watched the video and as Sarno was explaining his thesis, she started to wonder what it was that might have been going on in her shoulder. And she started to breathe. She started to cancel some goals. And all of a sudden a memory popped up. About 35 years earlier, she was raped. And she was raped by a man who held her down by her shoulders and kept slamming her shoulder onto the surface that he had her pinned down on. At that point, as that memory started to surface, she had put the video on hold. Actually, it was just before that memory surfaced, she put the video on hold to breathe and be with what was moving for her. And this memory of this rape started to surface, at which point she said she reached for the remote control to turn the TV, start the TV back up again so she didn't have to look. And she was aware enough, she'd done enough work to be aware of, oh, I'm trying to hide this. So instead of, you know, getting the video to start again, she just stayed there and breathed, and up came that full-blown memory. And her shoulder being repeatedly slammed on whatever surface was underneath her at this time. And last night, she said she was able to do all the things that she had been having great difficulty doing. She did them carefully. But several things that she had great difficulty doing with the recent pain in the shoulder, she did pain-free. Now, she's got a surgery scheduled for the next month, and she hasn't canceled the surgery, and I suggested, no, don't do that. But stay with and be with what's moving for you. And at this point, she's once again, after going through that process work, pain-free. Once again. Now, how many layers, how many times might we need to forgive? Well, if you go back to Yeshua, he was asked if 7 was enough, and the answer was no. It might take 77 times, 70 times. And there's a work to be done. And, you know, we talked about the insanity of the culture, and how is it that such a thing as rape could happen? And I shared with her an event that Jeannie and I experienced one day in a Walmart store. We were in line behind a woman who had a small boy who was about 3. And this boy wanted a grape out of the package of grapes she was buying and kicked up a fuss, of course, crying. And the mother becomes urgently upset. And she purchases her groceries and moves ahead to in line. And Jeannie's right behind her, and Jeannie goes ahead and checks out. And a few minutes before that, I had gone out to get the car to pick Jeannie up at the door with the groceries we'd bought. And as Jeannie was standing waiting for me, she heard this child of about 3. And when you think about why does a child of 3 even have such a concept as this, that he would speak these words? And you get to see the insanity that goes on in our family systems, in our homes, in our culture. But as this woman then, you know, trailed Jeannie out the door, she hears this little boy say to her mother, his mother, Mom, I love you. Please don't beat me. So if you need to think about why a rape might occur, you might think about a boy of three who already is conning his mother by saying he loves her out of hitting him. And of course, why would a mother hit a boy of three? Well, maybe she was the one being raped and has not worked through the rage of that rape as yet. And so a little boy resonates those brain cells and rage comes out in a cycle. And we're not saying somebody's to blame one way or the other. It's a cycle that we need to, as humans, learn to address the energetic dynamics behind the behaviors that we do that are not based in love. Elsewise, they will perpetuate those dynamics in our own lives and the people around us. So is the mother who hits the child to blame? No, but she needs healing. Is the boy who grows up to be a man, and when a woman resonates this, don't beat me, Mom, I love you, tied in with this twisted idea that we have in this culture of love, does that turn into rape? And when we start to heal these dynamics of hostility and fear in our culture, we can eradicate all of this insanity. And the objective of this work is to eradicate all of that insanity. So as I was speaking with this young lady, she just went into some really deep emotional pain, was able to breathe through it, and cry tears of joy at the opportunity to heal what it was that she was healing. And the insight to see that this is the way, particularly with this woman, she's had polio, and one of my favorite quotes comes from the man who invented the Salk vaccine, Jonas Salk, where he said the most important thing you can be is a good ancestor. And here she was, lifting a burden from her generations to her generations and opening the space for some of the deepest levels of healing that could possibly occur to a human being. And so it's just another example, and a very powerful one, of how physical an assault can become, and yet recognizing that, this is an injury that went back over 30 years. Now, was the injury physical? I don't know. But it was an injury all the same. It was a pain of unresolved power person dynamics. And one's willing enough to be with truth, to honor truth, and allow those dynamics to come up rather than hide them under the surface of physical pain or emotional abuse towards someone else. The person who would emotionally abuse another is emotionally abusing another because they've been emotionally abused. And somewhere, somebody has to pick up the skills. And fortunately, this woman's been doing this work pretty continuously for 30 plus years. And so she had developed the skills and the ability to listen, to be out of her mind, to allow her mind to go into a quiet space where it's giving her no input, so that the subtle guidance that comes, that is directly available to all of us, becomes available.
Michael, I think you muted all of a sudden.
Oh, excuse me. I did. I accidentally hit the mute button. So develop the skill and the ability to embrace the energetic patterns of trauma rather than reach out with trauma and traumatize yourself and someone else. Every time a person reaches out and traumatizes or points traumatic energy toward another, it's themselves they're injuring first. Every time one takes hold of an emotional trauma and chooses to resolve it, removes from their physiology what never belongs, removes from their nervous system what never belonged in the human nervous system, and hostility and fear never belonged in any human energy system. Now, we look down back through history that we know of and some of the insanities that have taken place. Time for deep, deep healing in our culture. And so this is just a powerful example of the kind of energetic dynamics. If one cancels a goal, which collapses perception and allows the underlying hidden dynamic to come forward. As distasteful as it is for those sorts of things to come forward. But what never comes forward for healing repeatedly plays out in a person's life. And because the mind is so adept at projection, it can massage its original pain into pictures of all kinds of people doing things to it and the belief that it's all everybody else's fault. The one world religion is alive and well in the world today, and it's been here for thousands of years. It is the religion of blame. It is the religion of denial, and this is all somebody else's fault. And you'll notice at the top of the worksheet, it's a no-fault process. There's no requirements, no benefit in establishing fault anywhere along the way. It's just a matter of recognizing what energetic dynamics are within oneself and throwing out the ones that don't serve, the ones that do not uplift the human being. And to recognize that the human being is love, and that life is love flowing through a cell. Anything we do to inhibit the flow of love through our cellular structures, any experience that restricts that is an experience that is in dire need of forgiveness in order to free one having to play that out through the replicant mind, playing it out over and over and over. Yes, massaging the original trauma into a picture that looks like Mary when Mary's the person involved, and then when it's Bill that's involved, the mind massaging into a picture of Bill. But you'll notice that if you've done that 87 different times with 42 different people, you were the one who was doing the massaging. You're the only one that was there every time it happened to you. And when we can design our relationships to be, instead of being about protecting ourselves, instead of being right, instead of shutting other people up so that we don't have to look at what's going on inside ourselves, when we create the space of gentleness and caring and support and safety that allows us to touch into those untoward energies that we all carry, and in allowing them to surface directly without projecting them into our brain's image of someone else. Life moves in ways that it has been restricted for so long that it's hard to even imagine. So we're here to support the removal of all restrictions of the flow of love through your cellular structure, through my cellular structure, so that the proper flow of energy can be restored. Literally to every mind, heart, and being on planet Earth, so that we can begin again to function as true human beings, living in and as the space of active present love, which I would offer is our birthright. So we're here to support the restoration of our birthright. And appreciate the fact that you're here lending your ears to this conversation, which means that energetically, wherever you are on the planet, this energy is extending out in your direction. And as the energy extends in every direction to each receiving mind, everything and everybody in between is touched by the movement of that energy. And when we can get this field of active present love to critical mass, then there's going to be a transformation like the world has never seen. And there will be a thing that was called the second coming. The mind of love will arrive upon the earth in mass. Like at this point, about 7.5 billion people. So that's what we're here to work on. And I would love to hear your thoughts, your suggestions, your use of the tools, your experiences with these principles. And if there's any way we can support you in the use of any of the tools, we're happy to. If you are not using the forgiveness process at this point, we invite you to go to our website, whyagain.com. In the upper left-hand corner of the page, you'll see a link that says Start Here. Click that link, and it will walk you through how to engage in this amazing hidden technology of forgiveness from the first century. You can download the worksheets for carrying out the forgiveness process from the website. You can do the forgiveness process live right there on the website privately. And or you can go to your app store and type in the words Heartland, H-E-A-R-T-L-A-N-D, Heartland, Aramaic, A-R-A-M-A-I-C, Forgiveness. If you type Heartland Aramaic Forgiveness into your app store, you'll be looking at the world's only forgiveness app. You can download it free. It was purposely designed to be totally and completely private. It asks only one permission, and that's to use the internet. When you complete your first worksheet, it will ask you if you want to save it as a PDF, which you can do, so you've got a record of your worksheets. And if you save it, it's going to ask for a second permission, and that is to allow it to write it to your hard drive so you can save it. Otherwise, the app's totally, completely private. We know that people put very intimate things into their worksheets. And so the app is totally and completely, strictly confidential. And one of the wonderful new features that Jeannie recently put into the app is that on every page, there's a button you can click, and it will open an email to send us a question. If you click that button, you know, you're on step four and you're not sure what this means or how this is supposed to be done, put your question in, hit send. Jean will get the question. She'll read it on the radio show. We'll answer it. She'll write back to you and give you the time and date that it occurred and how to access it in the archives. You can actually engage in two different versions of the forgiveness process from within the app. And then there's a third item, and that's a children's game called the Drag-On-Cling-On game that introduces children to forgiveness. So we invite you to take it and use it, pass it on to somebody else, and watch what happens. In the meantime, Miss Jeannie, do we have anybody in the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room?
It is all quiet. Nobody has a hand up. So if you have a question, press 1. We have 35 minutes. We have plenty of time to address your question. You know, I worked with somebody the other day, and they had mentioned the original worksheet that they learned many years ago. Had you list, you know, it didn't have you separate different feelings and thoughts and and emotions as different worksheets. And I said, well, that's probably true because the Dragon-Klingon game that you just mentioned, the child actually gets more points for the more answers. You know, if it can name two or three or four or five emotions and thoughts and feelings, then they get more points. And that game was originally designed back when Heartland first opened. I believe that Danielle
yes.
and them were there in 88, 89, something like that.
Danielle and JJ.
They,
yep.
Yeah, and so they created the Dragon-Klingon based on the way that you were doing the worksheet, I guess, back then. And it's also to get children to, you know, think a little deeper, to, you know, name all of the emotions that are going on for them and everything, and then to release all of them. But so I wasn't absolutely sure, but I guessed that it probably was that way because of the way that they developed that game.
It is. And that's available in the app. Thank you to Daniel and JJ for putting it together in that form. And, of course, we've also got, if you're working with kids, Julie Haverstick took this work and used it in the kindergarten and grade one classroom and wrote a book called Healing Children and Loving Children. And she was a kindergarten teacher, grade one teacher, and she put this work into a format that was age appropriate for the kindergarten child. And so that book is available if you're a parent or a teacher. You can go to the website and look under products and you'll find Healing Children, Loving Children. And she's got many ideas that she developed based in this work and her expertise as a kindergarten grade one teacher on how to bring children into awareness of themselves as love and how to support them in living as that presence of love. So if you've got little ones, it's an awesome gift to give them.
And we have a hand.
Great. Let's say hello.
It is Dusty 904. You're on the air. Hi.
Well,
aloha.
Howdy, everybody. Aloha.
Welcome, good sir.
You're doing well.
We are.
I have a
cold.
What's that? Yeah,
cold.
Oh, it's cold here. I'm not even going on the ocean today. And you use a word a lot, and I have a general understanding of it, but I wonder if you would do kind of a run-through, ground-up on Rachma, if you would, please.
Yes. Yes. Rachma is a word that was used back 2,000 years ago. They said to this man, Yeshua, and the Greeks mistranslated it. They asked him, what's most important in the law? You know, Yeshua is presenting this thing they called law. And so many things have been destroyed in translating his words, and this is one of them. First of all, the word law has been destroyed in this culture. Most everybody thinks, you know, the long arm of the law. Most everybody thinks of law as the rule of a superior. Somebody who's bigger than me is going to shove this law down my throat and make me follow it. And that human idea has been projected onto people's idea of the creator, and the creator being the lawmaker and forcing them to do things that they don't want to do, which could be, there's nothing further from the truth than that. And the word law in Aramaic simply means the way things work. So in essence, what they were asking Yeshua is, okay, so we're human beings. What's most important to living as a human being is the question they asked. And he did not say, love God, love neighbor as yourself, which the Greeks translated as. That is such a decrepit degradation of his words that the whole concept of creator-human relationship has been put on the skids by that answer. It's a terrible thing to tell somebody to love their neighbor. If there's hostility or fear in them, and you tell this child, you better love your neighbor, and you don't give the child a way to process out their hostility or fear, when their neighbor shows up, you know, resonating their hostility and fear, instead of loving their neighbor, they're going to point hostility and fear at their neighbor. And of course, having been told by some authority that God will only accept you if you love your neighbor, now you've got failure and guilt and all kinds of stuff added to it. So law is just the way things work. How do we live as human beings? And what he said is, the word he used that was translated as love, and it relates to love, but it is not the word love, is the word rachma. There is no such concept as rachma in the English language. There is no such concept in the Latin or the Greek. So, of course, they couldn't translate it. It takes at least a paragraph to understand it, as many words from the Aramaic do. So when he says you must have rachma, he's talking about a filter in the frontal lobes of the brain that, when open, allows admission of human life. It's a gateway that allows human life love to come into this human form, the so-called body. So that's its first function. So there are basically three filters or gateways in the mind. One's hostility, one's fear, and one is rachma, over the frontal lobes of the brain, over intentions. So if hostility and fear are active, because only one filter or gateway can be open at a time, then the other two are closed. So if hostility or fear are moving, the first law has been violated, because now we have just a human form with no active human life in it, because the gateway for its entrance and activity has been shut down by the activity of hostility or fear. So what he was saying is, well, if you want to have a human life, you've got to have the gateway open that allows your human life, love, into your form. And he names a couple of objects of attention, the creator and neighbor. He says, whenever you think of the creator, whenever you think of neighbor, you need to have this gateway open so that you maintain your human life. So the Greek translation, you know, you must love God, neighbor, as yourself. And what Yeshua was saying is, you must have this gateway open, rachma, so that love is present when you're thinking of creator and neighbor, and by so doing, you have maintained your own human life. So it had nothing to do with the creator or neighbor, except as a way to test ourselves. If I'm thinking of a neighbor where I have some form of hostility, have I lost the presence of active love? If I have, then I need to go back and reopen the gate so that active love, so my human life is vibrant and alive in me. I maintain that. And when I do, it becomes the power that dissolves the hostility or fear-based energy patterns, which often, you know, are passed to us through our generations and or through our culture.
Oh, okay. Okay. Yeah, thank you. Would I be correct then in saying that, because I'm trying to distill this in my brain a little bit, that a rachma then is the channel by which this love becomes in our human experience?
Yes, if that gateway is closed, if hostility or fear are active, then love is not present or active within our form. You know, my take is that our cellular structure, you know, my definition, the best definition I've been able to come up with as human life, as life, is that life is the presence of love flowing through a cell. If hostility or fear becomes active, love is voided, life is not flowing through a cell, and that's when people move into dis-ease energies, and ultimately, as a result of those dis-ease energies, those energies that don't belong, we kill ourselves. It's the cause of death, because the cell can only function for so long without its proper power supply, which is active present love. And it comes only through rachma being open. There's
okay.
a there's a corollary filter in the mind. So this is talking about the frontal lobes of the brain, which is where intentions are stored. In the back of the brain, where units of perceptual memory are stored, there's another filter that in Aramaic was called Kuba. Kuba is a corollary filter to Rachma. Rachma is a gateway that allows human life, love, to stay active in the human form, and it inhibits negative or destructive intentions from being active, and the only goals that can be active when the mind is set with that are those that are based in love. The reason that's important is because active goals, or pardon me, active intentions are the raw material of goals, and goals are what drive perception. Goals are what drive our guidance system. So Kuba is a similar filter, only it's over the back of the brain, and it allows only units of perceptual memory that are keyed to love to be used in building perception. So somebody could be in a situation where, you know, most people would say, oh, that's such a terrible, horrible, awful, ugly, vicious thing that just happened. And I am so enraged and, you know, whatever is going on in that individual. The person who has a Rachma and Kuba active in the same situation goes, yeah, this was just the ugliest, most horrible thing I could imagine happening. And I stay connected to love while I'm experiencing it. Rather than losing the presence of love in me to my own rage, guilt, grief, pain, drama, trauma. So it's a way to stand present as love with anything that happens in the world, and therefore to become a conscious healing force in the world. So when you might remember in this ancient scriptures, they made a statement, there was a statement that said, perfect love casts out fear. Perfect love in Aramaic would be defined as Rachma and Kuba active in the mind at the same time. And when those two filters are open and active, no matter what the external circumstance is, the mind cannot generate a fear-based experience. The mind can see something as, oh my God, that's disgusting. The individual that has Rachma and Kuba can do that from a centered, connected space of love where, you know, if there's a possibility that healing's going to happen, they're going to be able to see the way through and through to bring that healing about.
Oh,
so
nice.
It empowers a human being to really function as love.
So if I was to consciously, let's say, activate Rachma, I would basically open myself, open that channel to love and stay in that place. Kind of, I mean,
exactly
that way.
Precisely.
Okay.
If that extends to Kuba as well, then even in the situation that is most threatening, the most threatening situation you could be in, which for many people would put them into a sympathetic dominant state, disable higher brain function and cause all kinds of trauma in physiology, that person can stay connected to love, present as love, and if there's an opening for healing, is going to be connected enough to that active presence of love to bring healing to that situation. They're going to be functioning not out of the reactive replicant mind that just plays its traumas out over and over and over again, but they're going to be able to reach into that higher space of being and bring forward solutions that, you know, nobody else can even think of because everybody else in the game is linked into their replicant hostility and fear-based minds.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was his answer to that's what's most important in the law, in the way it works. If you want to function as a human being, you have to be aware of that. And, you know, I mean, as far as I know, I have in the last 50 years looked everywhere I could look for understanding and translations. And as far as I know, Rachma and Kuba have never been expressed or understood anywhere that I know of that I've been able to find.
Well, I've certainly never heard the words before. So that's oh yeah yeah I love that. Thank you for explaining that.
Honored and delighted, sir.
Yeah. Nice going. So in a way that, I mean, of course, it has to in some way tie in with Yeshua, the first law, right?
That was his expression of what that first law was. And if you want to be a human being, how does it work? If you want to function as a human being, how does it work is their question.
Right.
What's most important
so
in the law?
So from the greater law or the Yeshua, the human aspect of it is the dynamic process of Rachma. Is that right?
Yes. Maintaining the presence of love regardless of external circumstance. You watch most people that are rolling along and, you know, their love, oh, everything's wonderful, and, you know, I love you, and you're grand, and you're great, and then you speak the wrong word, or you turn your head the wrong way, and all of a sudden, it's, don't touch me, don't come near me, I never want to see you again. It's like, what happened? I thought this was a love relationship.
Right.
Well, no, it wasn't based in love at all. It was based in something other than actual love, and the world has, you know, really watered down the meaning of that word to something that just means nothing compared to what it originally meant and what it, if we understand it, the part it can play in our lives.
Okay. Well, I appreciate that. That ties a lot in for me because I have in my studies of, you know, worldviews and should we say religious beginnings or spirituality in different parts of the world, I've kind of issued going into the Mediterranean area because I knew it had been dominated by the, I love to tell the story, Greeks, and so this is beautiful. This is great to hear.
Well, delighted you asked the question, sir.
Yeah, man.
I couldn't have answered
so otherwise. Yeah, I guess that's what it takes. And for what it's worth, I'm still, I don't know, processing or oomphing or something, that experience that I rattled on about yesterday that you had reminded me of, the mystical thing.
Well, that's awesome.
Yeah,
Breathe with it and let it, you know, it may be time for the whole thing to open up again. Sounds like you might be preparing your field to another level of opening for that.
Well, that's brilliant, brother, because that's exactly what my mouth was about ready to open and say, because that was my intention when I went up there, was to upgrade to a whole nother plateau of the consciousness, awareness, whatever. And that's what I'm feeling now. It's different now, and my life is a lot more complex, but it is that, and that's very perceptive. I'm going with that anyway.
I'll go with you. You know, started this conversation is I accidentally came across this YouTube video about this fellow's mystical experience, and it just kind of took me back and tapped me in, and so I've been kind of dancing around that as well. So.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad to hear that. And I may have said it as an aside that while, of course, I had this experience stored back in my mental hard drive, I hadn't even thought about it in decades. I had forgotten that even happened until you know, dum-dum-dum-dum-dum, kismet or whatever, you know, brought it to focus. And I'm very grateful.
Go for
all
it.
The way around. Yeah, man. Well, hey, thanks a lot, and you all be super well, okay?
All right. You have a blessed one. Appreciate you, my friend.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Okay. Take care. Bye-bye. Oh, Miss Jean, okay. We're down to about
15
a little less than 15 minutes, yeah. So do we have anybody else out there in the phone queue with a hand up? Or Anybody else in the chat room?
No, but I had mentioned yesterday that you were going to be talking to Yinka. Have you all decided if the next book club is going to happen or if it's going to be postponed or moved to another day?
We're going to move it to another day, yet to be determined.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
And,
yeah, with the fact that it's at 3:30 in the afternoon and we've got our family gathering at 4 o'clock, it just doesn't make sense to avoid that. And so I've proposed to her that we might switch the date, but we haven't settled on something yet, but we will be changing it. We will go ahead with
okay.
that.
Okay. And then the situation at Heartland, if you want to mention that and get people thinking.
Oh, okay. Well, many folks have heard Michael on the show recently, and he's been at Heartland for the last several months, and he's going down to be with some family and friends in Texas. He's getting ready to go, but the building that he's staying in discovered that about a week ago there was a 3-inch rain. And we've got a leak in one of the buildings, and it was a leak that a roof that he'd been doing some work on previously that had some shingles that were having trouble, but it wasn't leaking. Well, it began to leak, and with the fact that we're not on the road generating cash flow as we normally do with being here to take care of Dad and Ari Rain and the fact of COVID, we're going to see if we can get a roofer there to actually there are a couple of things that need to be taken care of at Heartland, and so we're going to set up a fundraiser and invite people, if you are inclined to support us, to help to get that new roof put on so that that building is secure and take care of a couple of other projects that need to happen at Heartland. So if you're inclined to support us, that would be awesome, and I'm going to find out what's involved first. It's a small building, so hopefully it's not going to be too much. And we'll just put that out at this point and move forward with it. We've got about a little better than a $3,500 tax bill coming up at the end of December and this roof. So we're hoping that somebody will be out there that's benefited enough from this work to offer some support to help to make that happen. So that's one of the other projects that's going on. And, of course, if you're out there in listener land and you're on one of those stations where we can't see you and you'd like to communicate with us, our call-in number is 563-999-3581, 563-999-3581. If you call that number, you'll be listening to the show directly on your phone. And then if you
have
a question, push 1. There we go. Let's say hello.
I believe it's Miss Linda, 541. You're on the air.
I have to unmute here. How are you?
Welcome, young lady.
Well, did you post a link to that YouTube video on the mystical experience that gentleman had by chance on your last show that you talked about it?
It has not been posted yet because I haven't come up with it yet.
Oh, you haven't found it. And the gentleman was a scientist or something? Because I'd try to search it myself if I could find it.
Yeah, no, actually he was a professor at Harvard who taught MBAs.
Okay. And his mystical experience. A professor at Harvard who taught MBAs and his mystical experience. YouTube video. Okay, I'm going to go for it. And if I find it, I'll send it to you.
Actually, here we are.
Oh,
it's in
good.
Two parts. And, you'll remember that I had shared that the experience started with him. He found himself in a room with a woman that he realized was Mary. And so I just found it on YouTube. And so the title of the video, it's a 46-minute video, part 1, and then part 2 is 52 minutes, is Virgin Mary Appears to Harvard Professor.
Okay. So can you...
And that's how you
find
it.
Yeah. And can you put that in your link for others? Or can you
It will be in the notes for today.
Perfect. Thank you. I'm going to go.
So there's a part one and a part two.
Perfect. And also, I did a...
Well, there's a part three, too, and a part four, I just realized.
Oh, cool. You better go watch it. That's the nice thing about this path we're on, this way of perceiving life and our creation, is that there's always something exciting around the next bend.
For sure.
I wanted to share with you that I did a forgiveness process. I wanted to share with you and Jeannie. And you know how I come from my head first, and I've pretty much shut my body down from very small. Well, I was doing the forgiveness process kind of in the worksheet format. And
right.
For, I think it was the first time I was really conscious in a visceral way after I, after the experience I had, I was going through this process in my head, and all of a sudden I felt and was very aware of the tension in my body, the feeling of tension in my body, and that was my clue.
Right.
Because I was just convinced. And then I also became aware, mentally aware, so that I had fallen into the need, I had fallen into survival, which was a need to be right, because if I wasn't right, I didn't have any worth in which to exist. You know, there was no room for me because I really had no value because I was wrong. So it wasn't like I was dead, but I'm sure there, if I had extended that, it would have gone back to some sort of original experience I had in which I really felt I was going to die. But
that's one of the original thought disorders, is you're broken, there's something wrong with you. That's like one of the core ones that originally disconnects us from love.
Right. It's interesting that Louise Hay says that in all of her counseling with people, that seemed to be the bottom line thing if they dug deep enough. Where she was. Yep. And also, then there was a third component that I realized is that, and I'd like to tie this in with your perception of the post-traumatic stress when you said it's not really a disorder. The third thing was one of the things I had studied about trauma and post-traumatic stress, is that the person who's suffering from that continuously flips between rigidity and chaos. Well, I thought this was very, very interesting. It's like they would get in one place or the other. When they'd have symptoms, something, one or the other would happen. And it really was reflected in their lives as well, you know, their day-to-day functioning of their lives, rigidity or chaos. And I've seen friends of mine and family members of mine that seem to, some are stuck in rigidity, some are stuck in chaos, some flip back and forth between the two. Within my own life, I can see that also. And all of a sudden, I get this perception was life is not either or. It is both. And this is just where I am in this moment of time, Michael. I don't want to turn it into a doctrine or dogma. that we have this place we can walk between rigidity and chaos. So, for example, a chaos for me would be someone who has no boundaries or who has no in any area, and they tend to be gullible
because they have no boundaries and they have no perception of where the banks are for themselves. And then the rigidity is that opposite thing where the flow is so constricted in their life process that they can't even breathe. Does that sound familiar? That it's so restricted, it's so rigid, it's so dogmatic, it's so whatever word you would, perception you might have in that moment.
Right.
And I just wanted to share that. And I keep, and I went, oh, wow, that's what the middle path is that the Buddhists talk about, you know, the middle way.
Hmm.
And I thought, how sweet. I just wanted to share that with you.
Cool. Well, anything to share about your worksheet?
No, I feel very comfortable with it. And also,
good.
I've been doing some worksheets, several different worksheets, because memories are popping up of where I really felt humiliated and put down and disrespected.
Beautiful.
And these
beautiful
are
to get in touch with those.
Right. And I just, now all I have to do is say, oh, I mass cancel, you know, I cancel them all. If it comes up, Ruha, if you bubble it up for me, or and us together actually bubble it up, because of my permission, I have to get permission and ask. And so if you bubble it up, I'll cancel it.
Right.
I just wanted
well,
to
and isn't
that.
It interesting? You know, the tendency when people are trying to get in touch with the root of a trauma, what they turn to is their memory bank and try to remember.
Right.
But going back to the original thought disorder is not a function of memory. It's a function of forgiveness. And when you engage
right.
in the forgiveness process, bang, it's just there. And that, to
right.
me, that was a really valuable insight instead of somebody sitting around going, oh, what was the terrible thing? Oh, let me go lay on the couch for 20 years and see if I can figure out the
right.
terrible thing that happened. Then my life will be okay. As opposed to, what's the goal that my mind is holding now that's resonating this trauma out of some unresolved part that I'm not in touch with? And when I cancel that goal and my perception collapses in, it collapses in on itself, and that's where we get in touch with that original energy. To me, that's so profound. Because it's the very
right.
opposite of what the world is trying to do and remember it.
Right, rather than mucking around in the old memory garbage can. And yet what needs to come up, Ruha will bring up if we're willing to be shown. But we don't have to go around mucking around in the garbage. Well, if you remember Labyrinth, where she was in the trash garbage pit. And, yeah. We don't need to be there unless we want to be shown. And Ruha says, well, this is important. So this is what I want to do.
Well, and the idea, as opposed to muck, as you say, mucking around in the garbage, the idea is to be committed to walking through your life as active present love. And when life delivers an experience, it brings something less than that up in you, that's where you look for the goal that's driving the process, and you get to drop into the underlying energy and bring it forward and clean it out. It's such an elegant solution compared to the, you know, laying on the couch for 20 years.
Well, when I remember listening, and we're coming to the end of the show, I'm going to save this for another day.
We are. All right, young lady, you have a blessed one. Lots of love. All right. Thank you, buddy, for joining us. Blessings. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Mind Shifters Radio with Dr. Michael Rice and myself, Jeannie Rice, and Dr. Tim Hayes and Michelle Pichet. As we present the first century Aramaic internal process of forgiveness, we are here for two